will it take me under?
Welcome to Woke History. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I'm a college history professor in Washington, D.C. Woke History is a new podcast series that features lively conversations with guests focusing on historical and contemporary issues of race, gender, political activism, and culture that are often ignored in most high school classrooms and social studies textbooks. Guests will include a wide range of individuals from scholars and community activists, professional athletes, media personalities, and others. Today's guest is Dr. Brandi Thompson Summers. Dr. Summers is an assistant professor of geography and global metropolitan studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Her research examines urban cultural landscapes and the political and economic dynamics by which race and space are reimagined and reordered. She's published several articles and essays in academic and popular publications, including the New York Times, Boston Globe, and International Journal of Urban and Regional Research. The professor is joining me to discuss her 2019 book, Black in Place, The Spatial Aesthetics of Race in a Post-Chocolate City, which explores how aesthetics and race converge to locate Blackness in Washington, D.C. Let's begin our conversation. Dr. Summers, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So 2019, you published the critically acclaimed book, Black in Space, The Spatial Aesthetics of Race in a Post-Chocolate City. What's a chocolate city?
It's Parliament, Funkadelic, George Clinton. There's a song from 1970 called Chocolate City, right? And it was ultimately where they were identifying either majority Black or cities that were blackening up and really trying to identify the ways that Black people in a city meant that there was this rich culture, rich tradition, just a richness that we needed to be proud of, that we needed to celebrate. Mm-hmm. And so from, you know, we think about all the activities in the 1960s that moved into the 1970s, there was this way that Black people were really trying to say enough is enough as it related to discrimination, segregation, disinvestment, that we needed homes that were safe, neighborhoods that were safe. We needed access to clean water, food. We needed to end these terrible, you know, skirmishes with police departments and such. And so this claim of a chocolate city was more about recognizing that Black people were building these incredible locations. And so as far as it, you know, goes with the title of the book, thinking about DC as the first chocolate city in terms of it being the first large Black majority city. And, you know, a lot of people recognize DC as a Black city. It's now less than 50% Black, but for a long time, it had a majority Black population. And again, this rich, dynamic culture of Blackness that existed there.
And then by the title, Post-Chocolate City, this means that, well, I'm gonna let you, I think I know what you mean, but you could just explain it to the audience real quick.
Okay, so yeah, so really on the one hand, I'm speaking to the fact that it's not a majority Black city any longer, but there have been books and articles that have been written more recently that focus more on the whitening of the city. And so I didn't want to necessarily do that because I don't know what comes next. I just know that it's not the same chocolate anymore. I don't want to presume that it's the milk is changing the color. I think that there are other shifts that are happening that might make it a different kind of chocolate than what existed before. And so the significance of Parliament claiming, you know, the chocolate city is something to be proud of, the way I talk about in the book, and I'm sure we'll go into it in a little bit, but the way I'm understanding how Blackness kind of exists in the city today is very different than it did previously, than when we were celebrating the chocolate in the chocolate city. And so I'm recognizing that the post-chocolate is this aesthetic that might incorporate Blackness, but not necessarily include Black people in that process.
In the first chapter, you start with the uprising. I like to say uprising as opposed to riots that followed the assassination of Dr. King, April 4th, 68. Explain why that event's crucial to the evolution of Washington, D.C., and then, you know, in particular, 8th Street.
Right. So we're in agreement there with calling them uprisings. I put riot in scare quotes in the book rather than recognizing it. So it's either an uprising or a rebellion. So if we think about, you know, the 60s and it being this long decade, lots of hot summers of protest in various cities, DC was thought to be quote unquote riot proof because there seemed to be this growing and stable Black middle class. You saw that Black people tended to be faring better, supposedly, in D.C., where unemployment numbers weren't necessarily as high as other cities, where, again, you seem to have a larger population. And after segregation, there was this assumption that Black folks were living good. But when it came to Dr. King's assassination on April 4th, you started to see where there were the cracks in the foundation were starting to be exposed. So while the press seemed to be speaking about the assassination and his death as being basically the spark that lit the fire, there had been issues previous to that that really just enabled his death to expose so much of what had already been going on. So in that first chapter, it's the most historical chapter. I talk about 8th Street, mainly because I want people to understand that the only, you know, significant Black neighborhoods in DC weren't just the U Street corridor, weren't just Shaw. Like you mentioned, Howard University being in the Shaw neighborhood, U Street corridor being known as the Black Broadway of DC. I wanted people to recognize the significance of this particular corridor in Northeast DC for what I spoke about earlier about its everydayness. So no, it wasn't the epicenter of entertainment, but it was a place where, especially prior to segregation ending, it's the only place where Black folks could really go and get, you know, their service needs met, retail needs met, go to a drugstore, go to, you know, an appliance repair shop. And so because they were barred from shopping downtown. So it ended up being a really important commercial corridor in the city, especially for Black folks. And there were some Black business owners as well on the street. And so there were ways in which that particular corridor was understood as this Black business corridor and Black shopping corridor. So for it to be one of the three corridors to burn was really significant, again, because Black folks were tired of, you know, price gouging, tired of discrimination. And this story, you know, the understanding that because it's a Black neighborhood or because it's a Black business corridor, the assumption that that meant Black folks weren't experiencing discrimination was crap. So they were acknowledging that there still was discrimination, that interest rates were higher for the particular purchases that they were making, that they were being surveilled, that there was police brutality and surveillance occurring at alarming rates, especially along the street. So the significance of his assassination really just enabled this opportunity to bring all of those issues to the table, and not just understanding the death of this and truly remarkable figure as being the only reason why. But yeah, my focus was more on the fact that everyday Blackness was under assault given these events. And this was an opportunity more than anything to kind of show the ways that they were dissatisfied with the conditions.
So the book really focuses on 8th Street, right? And how 8th Street has developed over the years, and how, you know, that really represents this notion of a post-chocolate city. On page 92, you write, "The retelling of the 8th Street history positions it as an ethnically and racially diverse space that was momentarily decimated by an overwhelming wave of Black degeneracy. In other words, Blackness does not represent the truth of the area. Instead, Black bodies are woven into the diverse fabric of the space, and that Blackness requires discipline in order to fit the seamless narrative of a diverse space that nurtures progress and opportunity for all." So I want to know if you could just unpack that statement and then explain how this connects to this idea of cultural tourism.
What was significant in writing the book was not only to document this history. And like you mentioned in that first chapter, I really kind of tell this history as it relates to the uprisings in 68, but I wanted to provide a different lens. So, because if you look at the newspapers, the local newspapers, they made it seem as though Black folks were just, you know, treacherous in tearing up their own neighborhoods. And that kind of language is very, very familiar, even today. Mm-hmm. We think about Ferguson and all the different areas, Oakland also, where it seems as though it's like irrational Black folks tearing up their stuff. Why would they do that to their own neighborhoods? Mm-hmm. And so there's not this recognition that it's like, we don't own this, right? We don't own the businesses necessarily. We may not even own the homes. If we think about kind of public housing and their we could talk, you know, ad nauseum about ways that Black folks haven't had access to those forms of capital building and accumulation. And so when I was talking about, you know, this narrative, what's happened through the transitioning of the neighborhood and through various forms of gentrification, there's this retelling of the story of that era that, you know, there were the Polish, Jewish, Italian, and Black shopkeepers who lived, you know, lived harmoniously in this neighborhood, and it was a great area for everyone. So if there is this more contemporary move to multiculturalism, or we see the diversity on the street today, it's only a reflection of what its long history has been. Mm-hmm. And that's what a lot of the materials that have been produced through the DC government and other affiliated organizations, that's the narrative that's being pushed, that it's kind of like this return to diversity. But I was able to look at various documents throughout time, planning documents, if we think about the Office of Planning over time and thinking even about the federal government and its retelling of particular histories during the 1960s and 70s, you see that that's not necessarily true. And if it was, it would be an outlier. So the rest of the city is experiencing racial discrimination and inequities, but this area wasn't. It didn't make a lot of sense. And especially since, you know, this area, like others, experienced white flight. And so I wanted to really kind of acknowledge that it wasn't necessarily that white people just decided, hey, I want to go move to the suburbs because it's more land, but that they were encouraged to do so, that there were federal programs that were subsidizing their moves. And so there were shopkeepers along 8th Street who weren't Black that were able to move to other neighborhoods in the city while maintaining a business on 8th Street. And so they weren't necessarily part of the community anymore. It's just they did business there. They didn't have that same type of relationship any longer. So it's the story about it being a multicultural area bolsters this claim that Black folks were just one of many and that it wasn't necessarily a Black area. And that's significant in terms of how you're able to plan for the future, how you're able to justify certain geographic, but then also, you know, these historical shifts and what the neighborhood's going to look like in the future. And that matters. That kind of discourse does matter, despite it seeming like it's just symbolic. It actually has material consequences when you think about kind of what people will believe about a particular, especially commercial area.
So now we have the 8th Street Festival. So why is that significant to this story that you're telling us?
The 8th Street Festival, I mean, it's a good time. You know, it's good music. You see the businesses come out. They provide, you know, samples of their food. It's a really festive occasion. But like so many festivals, the intention is to garner some money and attention to the area. So one of the outcomes of the 8th Street Festival every year is that they get more applications for the new buildings for people to lease or buy condos in these very expensive buildings after it, because it seems as though it's this very festive area. So we see these ways that the festival draws on a Black history, but it also draws on a multicultural contemporary history that invites, honestly, more wealthy white folks to come to the area. And so it's not alone. I mean, there are those types of street festivals that occur in most major cities. And in a way, it's, you know, this idea that we can come together as a diverse community and celebrate ourselves, But what they end up doing in a lot of cases is erasing kind of the everyday work that occurs on the street, or the everyday work that contributed to the development of the street or how it exists today. So it's a marketing tool, as I see it, as a lot of these festivals end up being, because of their interest in bringing in more traffic, whether that be from tourists or from people all over the city, to where it's this attempt to make it seem as though it's safe and inviting, despite these ways that they're trying to push out any of the ugly or messy or poor elements that the neighborhood had, or that had existed in the neighborhood previously. But Anwar Salim is the Main Street's executive director for H Street. And he's been a huge supporter of H Street. He's a business owner on H Street. He lived in the area. He actually, unfortunately, had a friend who died in the uprisings in 68. So he's very familiar with the neighborhood and has a lot of investment in the neighborhood. But he's certainly the most involved as it relates to its unfolding and it happening essentially every year.
And when you attended, describe the demographics in terms of who was there from what you remember in the past.
So, you know, it grows every year with, of course, the exception of this last year. But, you know, when you have beer gardens, there were more young white people. When you start having larger corporate sponsors, you have more white people. Even if you have seven go-go stages, over the years it changes. You got to have a rock stage. You got to represent the diversity of the city. And in this case, the city is becoming less Black. And so I started to see the ways that, one, there was an opportunity for politicians to come in and try to get people to vote. But what was happening was the demographics of the city were changing such that you have to start appealing again to more moneyed classes. And again, in DC, like in so many other places, that means white. That might mean Asian to a lesser extent, but certainly young. So you see in terms of age and presumed class that it's younger, higher wage earners. There were certainly children there and people bringing their families, but as the weekend would draw on, you started to see this different demographic that was hanging out. Like I said, the beer garden crew would be there in larger numbers than any other.
So in the book, you discuss transportation, right? And how racial dynamics play into things such as bridges and you know, the streetcar. Talk about that.
So yeah, I have this keen interest in architecture too, and thinking about the built environment. And so looking at, you know, structures like bridges, where in the case of H Street, it's a footbridge, but one that's driven over, that covers train tracks below. And so for those who aren't familiar with the area, there's a Union Station is right basically on the tip of H Street. And so that's where, you know, the Amtrak trains are. That's where there's a bus depot. So the Chinatown buses that go straight to New York, where you have Greyhound buses. But then also commuter trains go through there. So it's a very busy area at the western end of H Street. And so there's a collection of railroad tracks that exist beneath the street. And so they needed to build something to enable people to go back and forth across H. The issue is, of course, that the hopscotch bridge is what it's called. It goes into the air. Like if you're on H Street, you can't see downtown from the street because of the elevation of the bridge. And because there are train tracks below, you literally could have built it so that it went straight across and the trains would still be able to fit beneath the pedestrian and the bridge. But instead, it was built in the 70s as part of the FHA projects, where it created this visual obstruction. And so I'm making various claims of these kinds of decisions that end up having a profound impact on the population. You cut off traffic, you cut off vision to the area, you cut off, you know, commerce. Or it's this way of containing the space. And since H Street kind of went through this economic downturn, especially after the uprisings, if you're cutting it off from the rest of the population, then you're not able to see it grow. And so there seems to be this way that there's an intentional disinvestment to where later private capital can come in and invest and transform the area. But as we're thinking about it relating, let's say, to the streetcar, you know, the streetcar just started back up a few years ago. It had stopped, ironically, the same year that DC became majority Black, and specifically that area became majority Black. And so you have, you know, this 30, 40 year time period where the streetcar wasn't really discussed as a feasible option. And then it's revamped only to be a streetcar to nowhere. It goes basically 2 miles up and down the same street, which ironically is the same route that several of the bus lines that already exist on H Street already go. And so like most major US cities, the folks who catch the bus in urban areas typically are Black or brown, and are typically of working in lower middle class, right? So you have this way that the streetcar is being touted as this innovation that's kind of having this nostalgic look back on the past, but it doesn't do anything that's different than catching the bus. And so you create these separate spheres, these separate populations on these two very different types of transportation apparatuses. And it creates this kind of segregated movement along the street and doesn't, you know, and what I talk a little bit about the book too, in the book as well, is the fact that the construction around the streetcar ended up negatively impacting Black businesses, especially barbershops and beauty shops, who might have customers that stay for longer periods of time. And so if you've torn up the street, then you can't park on the street any longer. And when you have people coming in from Maryland or Virginia who don't have neighborhood tags and can't park in residential neighborhoods for long periods of time, these businesses start to lose customers. They start to lose their long-term customers. So all of these elements of infrastructure, thinking about construction, thinking about, again, moves that the city is making, still have this negative impact on the Black folks that are either living there or have their businesses there. And it's fully tied up in the transportation system. The last thing I'll say is the center of the corridor, which is at the 8th and H Street intersection, was identified and to my knowledge is still today the highest bus transfer point in the city. And so there was no intention for the Department of Transportation, DC's Department of Transportation, to change that. So what that meant was you had mostly these Black bodies going all day throughout this corridor, but again, only to move through it, not necessarily to remain. So as you see this transformation of the neighborhood, as you see the area gentrifying, not only in terms of residential space, but also commercial space, you're starting to realize the ways that the businesses there don't necessarily cater to the folks who are there to catch the bus or transfer to different points in the city. And so transportation, again, gets caught up in these ideas of who belongs and who doesn't, and especially trying to understand the particular infrastructure that the city is enforcing at the time.
So I want to move into culinary and talk about food, right? Mm-hmm. So how does the opening of a Whole Foods market and a Cluck You Chicken become a political issue? Why is this not just, I'm just trying to get my eat on and that's it?
Sure. So that's funny. Yeah, the Cluck You Chicken story. So, you know, the culinary piece was something that was accidental in that you start to notice with a lot of commercial corridors or entertainment corridors, they want businesses that can serve you food. And so you can start, what I started to do was pull archival data on the types of businesses, the types of restaurants that were in the area and how they transformed. And so we'll read, you know, pretty regularly about food deserts, right? Or even thinking about grocery stores that don't necessarily serve clean, healthy foods for particular neighborhoods. And so with H Street, especially in the 70s, and also as there was a push for Black business to really kind of be located in Black neighborhoods, you saw opportunities potentially for, let's say, a Black grocer, or again, for Black eating establishments. But there wasn't necessarily the infrastructure and support financially for these types of businesses to thrive. So if we go through this period in the 1970s and 1980s and even 1990s, because I also talk about the now closed Horace and Dickies, there wasn't much financial support for those types of Black businesses to exist. And if they did, they had to follow certain rules, right? And so it makes it more challenging for establishments like a Cluck You Chicken, which might serve a particular class or race of people, and let's say working class Black population, that they can't, let's say, implement, you know, cloth, tablecloths or, you know, metal silverware and still be able to remain because they'll still be seen as a fried chicken joint, right? Whereas if a global behemoth like Whole Foods comes in, there's this recognition of it being forward-thinking, organic, for the people, there's statements about diversity and how they really work with different communities. And when they came to the 8th Street area, they talked about how the values and ethics were the same between the company and the neighborhood. But what was most significant about Whole Foods, at least when I saw it, was that there was a Chocolate City display in the Whole Foods on 8th Street. And by their Chocolate City, they literally meant chocolate. They didn't mean Black folks. So to have, you know, to walk into this very expensive, and this is before Amazon had bought Whole Foods, but to go into this very expensive grocery, you know, global grocery store, and to walk in and see a Chocolate City display next to the organic, you know, carrots, it was alarming. And it was like a slap in the face to know that this particular establishment had replaced a Murray's grocery store, which before that had been a Safeway, a small Safeway, that was very significant for the community that existed previously because they'd sit in the driveway and play cards or play dominoes, or you just have elderly gentlemen sit and chill and talk, right? Which now would be seen as a form of loitering, but for them it was more so this way to, you know, create community. So it wasn't necessarily that the store just served particular needs in terms of food, but it also had this kind of social fabric that was being built at the time, especially when the street had been cut off. So the significance of a store like Whole Foods coming in, taking over the same area that was previously a storage facility and also a local grocery store, had this profound impact on the culture of the street. Now, there is not only a Whole Foods, there's a Giant Foods, there's still a large Safeway at the end of the corridor, on the eastern part of the corridor. That's a whole mess. That's a whole other story that I didn't get into too much in the book, thinking about Heckinger Mall. But the significance of it being a Whole Foods stands in and makes it representative of this movement towards gentrification, or at least that means it's kind of like we've officially arrived. Like, yeah, we're officially at a place where this is no longer a Black neighborhood. We are at a place where we're acknowledging this global diverse community, and that's when we're trying to attract different people.
But I wanted to get your opinion, Professor, just quickly about Don't Mute DC and how that ties into this bigger story that we're talking about.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought this up. Yeah, I actually just published an academic article about Don't Mute DC. And Go-Go was seen as lower class. And also it was policed which clubs were playing Go-Go and where there would be a crackdown of suspected illegal activity or something going on, or whether they were presumed to have firearms in these establishments. And so it really hurt the Go-Go clubs financially to where they couldn't survive in the city because they were constantly being surveilled. And so the significance of this moment I was writing about is more focused on how the sound of, they're okay with the sounds of gentrification if it relates to construction even police sirens or ambulance sirens, but they're not okay with the sounds of Blackness that kind of exude from the speakers. And so the significance of the moment, I think, is not just about the music, but the opportunity for activists and people who are go-go lovers to use this chance to say, hey, we're not taking this anymore. Like, we're not leaving our city. And so what that was able to do, they were able to transition this movement to impact funding, to get legislation passed by DC council members. Kenya McDuffie and Robert White also introduced legislation for returning citizens. They used the fervor behind go-go music being silenced to recognize how silencing go-go music was in effect a violent silencing of Black people in the city, and that gentrification had been so rampant. And I don't know if you recall that same year that there had been the report that DC was the most intensely gentrified city in the country. And so the recognition that, you know, 20,000 Black folks had been displaced and dispossessed from DC over, you know, a period of 10 years, that it was so significant that the bloodletting was happening, that we needed the music to kind of bring attention back to this particular erasure. And so it is a way that where I focused previously more on kind of the visual aspects, the aesthetics, the visual aesthetics, the whether it be through art or recognizing visual art or recognizing again, kind of these visual representations of Blackness I talk about in the book. This work, I think the sonic dynamics of understanding gentrification and also placemaking for Black people is really significant in DC, where go-go had been understood as this, again, debased culture that was for more lower class Black folks, when in reality, it was a really important and foundational sound for the city. Those types of things are really important to kind of maintain an understanding of how Black history, how Black people made DC in such significant ways.
Two-part question. So do you see any positive value in gentrification, one, and two, could you be comfortable living in an upscale community that is the byproduct of gentrification?
I think in a lot of ways, how we define gentrification has just gone off the rails. And so seeing it as this way the various markets are being privatized or produced around public goods, no, I don't think that's good. I don't think it's okay to transition things that really should be providing access to more resources, ways that basic services like ambulatory or, you know, social, again, other social services are being privatized. No, I never think that's a good idea. What I do think is good, which isn't necessarily gentrification, is financing for a community that wants to remain. I think it's important to provide basic services, water, trash, cleanup. What else? I think the value of her home should be stable. I think all these things matter to maintaining a community, but I don't think that needs to come through gentrification. And so ultimately, no, I don't think it's a good thing. But I think elements that come along with gentrification can be good. Like I said, upkeep. So financing to upkeep your home, financing again to help you remain rather than your house being this financial tool for you to get some kind of extract some kind of profit. That's the problem. And what that does is it invites speculators, it invites investors. I mean, I'm still getting texts and calls from people trying to buy my house in DC. Yes. As it relates to a neighborhood that's been gentrified. So the quick answer is no. And why I say that is because oftentimes with those gentrified neighborhoods, it's not just that the house is nicer, right? Like that they've refurbished a home. It's more literally that like my neighbors look different. The neighborhood is different. So where I still have a home in Southeast DC, it is majority Black still. We're Ward 7 and it's a quote unquote stable community. But at the same time, Ward 7 and 8 are like 98% Black. So, you know, we have these longtime residents who have been there who could tell the history of the neighborhood. I love that. I can go ask my neighbor for coffee. I can ask them to pick up my mail. Those types of things that I think gentrification ends up breaking up. It does not help produce cohesive communities. It completely breaks that up, whether it be creating multifamily homes in a single home, right? Whether it's rezoning so that you don't have the ability, again, for these neighborhoods to become more cohesive and together. So, you know, I think the house is oftentimes what we focus on and not the community. Yeah. I don't want to move into a gentrified community because then we're not going to have that face-to-face contact. We're not going to have kind of those same experiences. I'd certainly recognize that as a Black woman who is educated, who makes a certain amount of money, that presumption is that I am a gentrifier, but I think there are more activities that are involved related to how the state is essentially helping me transition the neighborhood that I don't necessarily take part in.
Well, Professor, what would you say to someone who says that we need to like stop focusing so much on race if we really want to get ahead as a society and a nation?
This is the post-race or question, right? Or commentary that people want to have and have been wanting to have, this colorblindness, right? That really was pushed by Republicans and conservatives. It wasn't pushed by progressive people. That race is foundational to this country, that slavery is foundational to this country and really the world. And so we can't not talk about race. You have to. In fact, we should talk about it more. And that's been the problem. These ways that euphemisms are used to cover up conversations that we could explicitly be having about race. And so I actually want to talk about Blackness, right? So not just race generally. I think oftentimes our conversations about race have to do with anybody who's not white. Whereas white people are raced as well. They are racialized in real significant ways. And so while my conversation specifically is about understanding Blackness and the experiences of Black people, we certainly need to be very clear about the ways that race, whether you're white or not, has a profound impact on your life chances. It has a profound impact on your experiences, where you live, where you eat, who your partners are, et cetera. We cannot exist without understanding the significance of race. It is as basic as I don't know what. So it's dangerous to try to cover up the significance of race, especially in the United States, where we are this very diverse multicultural society that was founded on that, founded on those principles. It's ignorant beyond that, but it just doesn't help anyone to try to cover up what is so plain and clear. And last thing, it's like, I think about it in terms of, you know, I have a 7-year-old, and one of the things that I wanted to make sure she knew about was race. And there are a lot of people who, you know, older generations who are not happy with how much I talk about race with my child. But at the same time, you know, she walks into a classroom, they are going to know she's brown. So why are we pretending like that's not happening? The concept that we shouldn't bring up race presumes that they're not thinking about it at the same time. They recognize that she's different. My issue is that I don't care if they recognize that she's different, they just can't think they're better than her. So it's about value, not necessarily about difference. And so if we can disarticulate those things, difference and value, then I think we can actually be more productive in our conversations.
What are your suggestions for urban planners and local activists concerned about questions of community space and social justice?
You know, I think for planners, and I've talked about this, I didn't realize how my work would be taken up by planners, or that it would be taken up by planners. Partially, I was introduced to planning through this project more so, and recognizing the origins of planning, if we think about various histories, are racist. I mean, just plain and simple. And so I think as it relates to planners, offices of planning in various cities, especially thinking about urban planning in particular, I think there needs to be a shift in focusing on who's the expert. It's so often that, you know, and this is the same for architects as well, where you go into a particular space and presume that you know the most, or that you certainly know more than the people who live there. And so I think there needs to be this reframing to recognize how the folks who have lived there probably know a lot more than you do, despite your education, background, experiences. And so in that way, I do think it, you know, there's opportunity for there to be more planners of color, specifically more Black planners who have experience in certain neighborhoods, but also recognize practices that have kept the neighborhoods together. So no, it may not be, you know, legible to folks outside the community, but to a certain extent, that doesn't matter. If you give people resources to do what they need, then they'll get it done. That's what happens. So as it relates to activists, I think there needs to be, I think the work that they're doing is incredible. A lot of organizing around maintaining communities, around organizing mutual aid, especially now since COVID has hit us so dramatically. There needs to be more emphasis on more collective organizing, and honestly, feminist methods of understanding community, that you have, you make sure people have access to food, to healthcare. Those types of elements end up being practices that Black folks have been doing for years. And so for these neighborhoods, I think that planners can tap into these more situated forms of knowledge that aren't necessarily kind of taught in their master's program, that instead that you start to learn what's going on and really not think that you're necessarily empowering other people. They already have the power. They already have the knowledge, but more so that you're coming to learn to see how you can be of service to them rather than being of service to you.
And on that note, you mentioned feminism. Real fast, when you say like feminist, what do you mean by that in terms of how that relates to planning?
I think it's really thinking more about breaking down that difference between kind of like domestic space and the public, right? And so understanding how we can think about domestic space as being very feminine in that it's usually women who are doing that work, but it's so often that in the public it seems more masculine, right? That it's the work is being done by men. The reality is that is not true, and that we need to really kind of break down the presumed barriers between domestic space and the public, and instead kind of bring them together and recognize the ways that, again, thinking more collectively instead of individually will help us get into these better conditions or help more people thrive and survive. We're seeing the homeless rate go up exponentially, and we're going to see it even more as a result of this health and economic crisis. And so ways to recognize that, you know, just honestly, what a lot of people think, that you're not on the street because you aren't working hard enough, or you're not on the street because you're bad, right? But recognizing how various structural conditions make it so that folks can't afford to live in a home, folks can't afford to feed their children, folks can't afford to have adequate transportation because of longer histories of planning that don't provide adequate, you know, structures for people to exist in. So the feminist element is the more collective element, understanding that we are a community, and to how you build community by making sure everyone participates and everyone is healthy. Everyone can find ways or pathways to happiness that way.
Dr. Summers, where can people find copies of your book?
Yeah, so Black in Place is on the behemoth Amazon, but also through the University of North Carolina Press. So if they Google UNC Press, my book can also be purchased there.
Dr. Summers, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Josh. This is great.
And that's our show for the week. Special thanks to today's guest, Dr. Summers. If you like what you heard, please check out future episodes. A special shout out, as always, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.